Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Today's Football Times, a podcast series from These Football Times. My name's Gary Thacker, and today, alongside a couple of friends from These Football Times, we'll be discussing issues from the last week or so and looking forward to upcoming things. So let me introduce the guys who are on the podcast with me this week. So first, Aidan Williams. Aidan, how are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, evening, Gary. Doing very well. Thank you very much. And looking forward to another one of these pods. They're always the range of topics we get into are all over the place, frankly. But that's the way we want it. That's the way we love it. So, yeah, looking forward to getting into it again.
All over the place in a good way, I presume you mean by that.
Yes. Oh, good. Yeah, absolutely.
And our other colleague, or the TFT colleague, is Dave Bowler. How are you doing, Dave?
Good evening, all. I'm doing fine. Thank you, Gary. Looking forward to talking about the weird and the wonderful in the next hour or so.
Okay, so what we're going to do is look at our first approach, which is look at the problem, the issues from the last few weeks. So let's start with you, Aidan. What's your topic for discussion, matey?
Okay, well, I've opted to look at a famous old club, about as old as it can get, like one of the oldest clubs in the world of football, and they're riding high at the minute. That's Queen's Park up in Scotland. Obviously, they're a remarkable and historically significant club. They're the oldest football club in Scotland. Like I was saying, they're very, very old. Founded in 1867, the oldest in the world outside of England and Wales. Famous for various things as well. You know, they were pioneers of the old passing game, which helped Scotland, of course, to some of their biggest wins over England in the past, in the dim and distant past, I should say. It also led to Queen's Park winning the Scottish Cup 10 times, and they're still, incidentally, to this day, the third most successful team in the Scottish Cup, behind Celtic and Rangers, obviously. But that's a remarkable statistic, especially when you consider they haven't won it since 1893. They have also reached the English FA Cup final twice, which is quite a unique feat for a Scottish team. The other thing they're famous for is for most of their history, they've been staunchly amateur as well, despite playing in the professional leagues. They even have a nice Latin motto, which I'm about to butcher here, Ludere causa ludendi, which, as we all know, means to play for the sake of playing. It's like the Corinthian ideal from days gone by in England. And that's how they remained for 152 years of their history, much of it while playing at the National Stadium, Hampden Park, which always struck me as a bizarre situation for a club who was usually in Scottish League 2 or the fourth tier in Scotland, whatever it's been called at various times in the past. Massive stadium, all these big stands or terraces as they were, and then you've got this lowly amateur team playing in front of a couple of hundred people. Anyway, that all changed in 2019 when they voted to become a professional club, in part, I guess, because they kept losing players, which in itself wasn't an issue, but the fact that they never got compensated for them, I guess that was becoming unsustainable. The point I'm rambling and getting round to is that this led to successive promotions, and they're now high-flying at the top of the Scottish Championship. So within reach of the promised land, I guess, the Scottish Premier League, which would be an astonishing achievement for this club that, like I say, only turned professional in 2019. That was when they were in Scottish League 2, the bottom of the four tiers, like I say. The first full season of professional club was in 2020-21, which was a shortened season actually due to COVID, but they ended up top of the league there. Moving up to League One. Last season, they found things a little tougher in League One, finished fourth, actually, but going into the promotion playoffs, and they got past Dunfermline Athletic from the league above in the semi-final, and then they beat Airdrieonians over two legs in the final, winning an extra time. So that's two successive promotions. But the form they are in right now, sitting pretty atop the championship. So the other teams they're with, some big, ish, some less big, you know, Ayr United are close. Dundee, I guess, are the biggies that are in there with them. And Partick Thistle are the next two teams in the table. But Queen's Park have already got more wins this season than they had in the entire last season when they still managed to work their way to promotion. They're now actually managed by Owen Coyle. And I guess this is a sign of their new lofty status. as a professional club. I mean, they obviously wouldn't have had somebody of his stature, whatever we think of his time at Bolton and his repeated mention of Barclays whenever he was doing an interview, I seem to recall. Whether he still gets dressed up in full kit on the sidelines, I'm not so sure. But, you know, this is a stature beyond a League Two amateur club, obviously. Coyle has won this league before as well, actually, with Falkirk a few years back. But Queen's Park, I just think there's something massively, massively appealing about how well they're doing, given their history. You know, this isn't just a rags-to-riches story or a rags-to-moneybag story like Gretna a few years ago, who rose through the Scottish leagues and then went pop because they flew too close to the sun. This is a storied club. This is a iconic club. I guess the most historic club in Scotland. I'm sure Celtic and Rangers fans may have a thing or two to say about that, but Queen's Park has a different history, shall we say, a different type of history to those two clubs, which makes it special. There is a lot of football still to be played, of course, but it would be absolutely remarkable. They may get to take advantage, I guess, of poor showings of the likes of Inverness, Cali Thistle, who are well adrift at the minute. Arbroath, who themselves would be a small club who nearly went up last year to the top flight. They're struggling a bit this year, but I guess Dundee are the biggest one they really need to worry about. They're also playing because they're, and I mentioned Hampden Park before, their ground is the Lesser Hampden, which is a weird name, I think. But that's under renovation right now, so they're playing at Stenhouse Muir. But even if they manage to sort out Lesser Hampden and get promoted, that's still going to be a tiny ground for the likes of Celtic and Rangers to turn up to in the Premier League. So that would be strange. But equally, what I think is, are they potentially, the fear, are they overreaching? Are they going too far beyond their means? Or are they simply overachieving and this is just the natural course of the promotion and relegation pyramid structure? Is it worth the risk of flying so close to the sun? I mentioned Gretna there. I hope they don't become another Gretna. A club I actually used to see, Gretna, in the Northern League in games near here when I was a young lad. They used to play in the English Northern League, but obviously it's across the border in Scotland. And it was always bizarre to me that a team I'd seen play in front of about 50 people at one of the local non-league teams here suddenly ended up with all this money and in the top flight in Scotland. But that's another story. But Queen's Park, so I really, really hope it doesn't turn out that. I would absolutely love them to go into the top flight because I think it would just be a really special thing to see this historic, famous club pitching up against Celtic, Rangers and the rest in the top flight. I think it would be absolutely remarkable. They may not cope too well on the field, but hopefully they'll cope well enough off it. They do seem to be a club saying all the right things. You know, they're focused on developing young players. They've got a director of football that they lured from AZ Alkmaar in the Netherlands, which, again, that's another incredible sign of their lofty status. They've got an elite academy now, as awarded by the SFA. So if they do unearth another Andrew Robertson, who is, I guess, the most famous contemporary name to come through Queen's Park, at least now they'll be fully compensated if and when they move on to bigger and better things. That is a tried and tested path to sustainability, I guess, for clubs at this level. So hopefully that's what they'll achieve. The chief exec says they want to carry on making history. Obviously, the history is the appeal in this club. But have they lost something in leaving their past ideals behind? Am I being a bit of a naive romantic, perhaps? But have they lost something in becoming professional? Their USP, for want of a better phrase, has gone. Are they just a club like any other now? That's the question that this throws up for me. What do you think?
I guess, you know, we could do an entire podcast on this one, but there's so many things there. Just, I mean, I guess the first question, I mean, Queen's Park, for a lot of football followers who don't sort of aren't intricately involved with Scottish football, will be the sort of the most famous uncelebrated club in Scottish football, because, you know, everybody knows who Queen's Park are. They're an amateur club and they're sort of, you know, home is Hampden and that sort of thing. But aside from them, before I just invite Dave to comment, just want to ask a quick question. Aside from turning professional in 2019, I think you said, what's changed? What's brought this dramatic turnabout from a team that sort of is used to languishing in the lower parts of the lower league of Scottish football into a team that's on the verge of sort of getting into the big boys league?
Yeah, what I haven't looked into is where the money has come that's funding it, but they have attracted a number of professionals, and I guess initially those from the league above where they were at the time, and they ended up with a squad that was good enough to achieve this. To achieve it twice in a row, promotion so far, is quite remarkable. But it's focused on young talent, and I think that's the key, which I guess is something that they always did. But now they're able to do it and to train them up to a higher standard because they've got all the academy structures and so on behind it. But I guess they have been able to recruit, and there must be the money. You know, it's small fry compared to the amount of money that we see in England at the top flight or close to it, I'm sure. But they must have the resources, I guess, to attract people. But there must be something also in the name, the appeal, the allure of being part of something big at such a historic club. I'm sure that's played a part in being able to attract certain talent. And I guess Owen Coyle and the likes as well. So they have brought in people who can push them on to the next level, people who have more experience in the professional world and the players they've been able to bring in. So yes, there must be an element of finance behind it. But there's got to be a bit more to it than that. So I think, yeah, there must be something additional in the appeal of taking Queen's Park. You know, people often talk about, or players probably more than anyone else, talk about the project they're coming to join when they look at a new club and they move there. And I think if we veer into managerial speak for a second, I think that's got some sort of appeal. You could imagine that to a player who is in the lower reaches of the Scottish Premiership or another Championship club, looking at another season of struggle at Kilmarnock or Ayr United or whoever it may be, the opportunity to play for the famous Queen's Park and be part of something that is building and building and building must be quite appealing. But yeah, there must be some money as well.
Dave, Queen's Park, football fairy tale or financial crash waiting to happen? What do you think, mate?
I don't think it's going to be a crash. I mean, it's interesting Aidan mentioned Gretna. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who works up in Scotland about this once. I knew that Aidan was going to talk about it. And they are well backed. I mean, they have got some decent investment and have done for a few years, but not on the insane scale that we used to in England. But I think what they've done with that money is they've built from the ground up. What they've done is they've invested in a really good infrastructure. You know, I'd mentioned the academy and that kind of thing. That's where they've started. The CEO that you mentioned, Leanne Dempster, and she was at Motherwell and then at Hibs. I think both of them qualified for Europe when she was there as CEO. So she obviously knows her way around Scottish football and a serious player. And I think the one advantage that they've got now, where you can see a path into professional football, is that they're in Glasgow. And there's a load of kids, 10, 11, 12, 13, who might go into the Celtic or Rangers Academy. And let's face it, it's not that dissimilar to going into the Chelsea Academy or the Manchester United Academy. The chances of you coming through and playing are pretty slim. Whereas now, if you're a 12 or 13-year-old, 11, 12, whatever it is, and you're being scouted, well, suddenly Queen's Park is... That's quite an attractive thing to the kids because they can see, well, A, they're in the Championship in Scotland. There's a potential they might be in the Premier League in Scotland, and there's a much better chance of them coming through and playing. You know, you mentioned Andy Robertson who came through from there, Lawrence Shankland who plays up front for Scotland. He's another one that came through the Queen's Park ranks. So I think for young players, they are now a really attractive place to go. And, you know, obviously all the other clubs, Aberdeen and Dundee United and Hearts and Hibs, have all looked to scout in the west of Scotland, in and around Glasgow. But those kids now don't have to move there. If they don't fancy Celtic and Rangers for the obvious reasons, then they don't have to move to an Aberdeen. They can go and play at a Queen's Park. And I think that's the big thing, it seems to me, that distinguishes them from Gretna. I mean, Aidan's right that, you know, Gretna piled money and money and money onto it, and then got to the point where the money ran out. They hit they hit the wall, as it were, when they got into the Premier League, and it all fell apart. I don't think that will happen with Queen's Park because I think, you know, we talk about clubs investing the right way and then it does eventually go wrong. But I think if anybody looks to have done it the right way and done it from the ground up with some proper foundations, and I think Queen's Park look to be that club. And, yeah, of course you lose some of the romance and the... But then if you want to keep the romance, then you're always going to be playing in the bottom division of Scottish football, and people like us are never going to be talking about you. If you want to have success, it depends how many levels of the Faustian pact you want to sign up to. I don't think they've signed up to the full thing. I think they've signed up, yeah, probably halfway.
Plus, of course, you mentioned the players again, that they've been through there. Now they will get money from those players moving on. They're not changing, I guess, their model, if you like. You know, it's take young players, develop them, and then see them take the next step, whatever that next step might be. I guess now that step is just a bit higher than it was before, but the model is still essentially the same. So yeah, I mean, it's one to keep an eye on. That's why it just piqued my interest, seeing how Queen's Park are doing. It's definitely one I want to keep an eye on. And if they do make it to the top flight, I think that'll just draw more attention as well. It'll highlight their past, which is something well worth learning about and knowing about, I think, because it's such a key part of football history for both sides of the border.
One issue perhaps with clubs that take a meteoric rise, the thing about meteors, they tend to burn up in the atmosphere as they land back, come back down to earth. I just, you know, just sort of think about clubs like Rushton and Diamonds, who had a money put into them, and you know, more recent time Wrexham, and you know, I just hope it's sort of, the problem is with sort of clubs that rise very quickly, that you wonder where is sustainable, where's the level that's sustainable. Because you mentioned overreach, and you know, it's great for a club, the romance is wonderful, but you just wonder if the overreach isn't going to cause a problem and a rapid downfall. I mean, you know, we're all football fans, we're all football dreamers, we love the romanticism of a club like Queen's Park going forward. But you know, Aidan, just briefly, do you think it's sustainable?
To a point, I think, yeah, they may find their natural level, and maybe they are temporarily overachieving right now if they go up. To be so sort of well set at top of the championship, maybe that is a step beyond where they thought they might be. But if they become a club, you know, I mentioned Kilmarnock, you know, Falkirk, Livingston, Dundee, and so on. Hearts and Hibs have had spells in the championship too. You know, if they become a club that is in and around the top levels of the championship and occasionally going up and having a few seasons in the Premiership, I think that would be an excellent achievement if they sort of consolidate it around that level. Maybe they'll go up and just have a couple of years and drift back down. And then, as you say, is the fear that it just sinks like a stone. From what I've read and what it sounds like they're approaching things, that shouldn't be the case, because they're not chasing the rainbow, if you like, in the way that some of those clubs might have been, in quite the same way. So I hope not. But I think their natural level may settle down to being championship level and occasionally getting a few seasons above.
Dave, before we come on to your subject for the reflection, shall we say, what do you think, sustainable or not?
I think they've got as good a chance as any side has that have come through the ranks over recent years. As I say, I think they've got all the building blocks in place. I think they're doing it the right way. As Aidan says, they're not going berserk and chasing this dream and piling more and more money and more and more money and more and more money and borrowing and borrowing and all of that. It seems a sustainable setup, and the opportunity for them to sell footballers, which of course they've never had before, you know, until 3 years ago. I mean, that's a game-changing thing, isn't it, really? If they find another Andy Roberts and they find another Lawrence Shankland, they're going to be quids in.
Yeah. Queen's Park, keeping the dream alive. Dave, over to you, which might be a sort of different approach to that sort of subject.
Well, we remain in Scotland. In the interest of full disclosure, one of the things I do is I help out a little bit at Aberdeen. I watch, and as a result, I watch all of Aberdeen's games, and it's been a hell of a week. I mean, they played all right in the League Cup semi-final, ultimately lost to Rangers, went down to 10 men for extra time and lost 2-1. And then on the Wednesday after that, they went to Tynecastle, lost 5-0 to Hearts. Then, of course, on last Monday, the worst result in the entire history of Aberdeen, probably the biggest giant killing in the history of Scottish Cup football, and they played Darvel and lost 1-0. And everybody thought that Jim Goodwin was going to get the sack, and the club came out and backed him, which, you know, was a courageous thing to do, as Jim said himself on Thursday in his press conference. Turned out, perhaps, might have been courageous, didn't turn out to be particularly wise, because yesterday they got absolutely thrashed at Easter Road 6-0 by Hibs, and I watched the game, and I have to say, Hibs didn't score a good goal. You know, the goals were absolutely appalling. It was a 90-minute car crash. And, of course, 20 minutes after the game, Jim Goodwin loses his job, and they're looking for a manager, another manager again. And it's such a bizarre... We're talking about Queen's Park perhaps going into the Premier League. I think the Scottish Premier League is the most difficult league to be in of any league, because you've got Celtic and Rangers, who are like a black hole, and they suck everything out of that division. And then the rest of you are all trying, although, you know, a lot of teams won't admit it, but basically you're trying to play for third place, and you hope that, you know, the draw is favourable and you might get to a cup final. And that essentially is what you're playing for. And that is a very difficult thing to sustain. Yeah, I was looking through some of the stats, and finished in third position over recent years. I mean, Aberdeen had a big run, which I'll come on to in a minute, but, you know, Kilmarnock finished third in 2019. As soon as they'd done that, they lost Steve Clarke, the manager, to Scotland. Motherwell finished third in 2020. They lost two or three players off the back of that. 2021, Hibs finished third. Well, since then, they've lost Doig, Porteous, Kevin Nisbet nearly went to Millwall last week. And then you've got to start all over again. And I think that's one of the great difficulties with Scottish football. And it's something that's afflicted Aberdeen particularly over the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, I was looking at the transfers earlier today, and it's quite terrifying, actually, if you're an Aberdeen fan. I mean, 2017, they lost Ryan Jack to Rangers and Johnny Hayes to Celtic. The following year, they lost Kenny McLean to Norwich, and Adam Rooney, I think he was, went to Salford initially. The following year, they lost Gary Mackay-Stephen and Graeme Shinney. Then the following year, they lost Scott McKenna. 2021, they lost Sam Cosgrove, who'd scored 20 goals a season, and Scott Wright, he went to Rangers. Then last summer, they lost Calvin Ramsey to Liverpool and Lewis Ferguson to Bologna. Now, that's a pretty decent team, actually, if you put that together. And to try and replace that year on year on year, I mean, that is a hell of an ask. And I think Derek McInnes, who was the manager there, and again, in the interest of full disclosure, I know Derek quite well because it used to be a columnist for me at the Albion. But I think what he did at Aberdeen is hugely underrated, because for 8 seasons, they qualified for Europe every year. I mean, that's a substantial level of consistency that no other club has come anywhere near in Scotland. And okay, there was that period when Rangers weren't in the top flight. There was two or three of those years, but even so, it's a big achievement. But the problem is, you know, he'd been there 7 or 8 years, and at the end, people got just fed up of it, as supporters do. You know, you want something new, you want something exciting, and that, I think, is the big question now for Aberdeen, because Derek got success at Aberdeen by being pragmatic. You know, they defended well. It wasn't always that exciting, but they got the results. And over the last couple of years since Derek went, they got Stephen Glass in initially and then Jim Goodwin. And the idea was that they were going to play a more expansive brand of football. They're going to be more attack-minded and all those sorts of things. And last season they finished 10th, I think it was. This season, at the minute, they're 7th. They may not get in the top six. They certainly don't look like getting into Europe at the minute. And that is the balance that I think is really, really difficult, and particularly so in Scotland, because, you know, you get to this time of the year and you get some pretty heavy pitches, and, you know, you're playing in all kinds of weathers, genuinely all kinds of weathers. There's two or three of the teams that have got plastic pitches, which doesn't help a great deal. I mean, my favourite is the all-weather pitch at Livingston. They've had 3 games postponed in the last 2 seasons. It's really not that all-weather. But Livingston are the great overachievers in Scotland. And Livingston do it, David Martindale does it, by being absolutely pragmatic. It's route one, pretty much. They hit the ball long, they defend in depth. And, you know, Livingston are going to finish in the top six, by the looks of it. They had a good draw with Hearts today. They, you know, I think they were on the edge of the top six last year, or maybe going in the top six. And they keep overachieving, you know, on gates of next to nothing. And I think that's the decision now for Aberdeen when they get the next manager. I mean, I feel for the supporters because they have fantastic support. They took, you know, 2,000 down to Hibs yesterday, 2,000 to Arts on a Wednesday night. I feel for Dave Cormack as well, who's the chairman there, because he is an Aberdeen fan. You know, he was talking yesterday when he made the decision about, you know, he's been following them since he was 6 years old and all of that. So it clearly means a lot to him.
Yeah.
But what do you do? You know, I look at some of the names that are being mentioned as potential replacements. You know, there's some people talking about getting guys in from Norway. There's talk about Neil Lennon coming back, which I'm not sure that the Aberdeen fans would take the Neil Lennon. I really don't. Paul Lambert's another one who's supposedly in the frame. Well, you know, that ship seems to have sailed quite some years ago. Owen Coyle's getting a mention at the minute in one or two quarters. I just wonder if there's a point where I understand. I mean, we're all supporters. We all say, well, what we really want to do is we want to be entertained. We want to see lovely football, which is great. But what we actually mean is we want to see lovely football, but we've got to win as well. if you stop winning, it doesn't matter how entertaining it is, the supporters will very quickly turn off. And you know, winning does cover up a multitude of sins, but it keeps people coming for quite a while. So I think they've got a big decision to make as to we keep trying to be expansive? Do we keep trying to go down this route? Or do we say, well, hang on, no, Livingston are doing the right thing. Let's just get back to winning.
I guess two questions come to that, Aidan. So the first one is, are Aberdeen just another club pushed to the precipice, clinging on by their fingertips because of the Celtic Rangers domination of the Scottish football? And secondly, is the pursuit of progressive football a dream that might turn into a nightmare?
Pursuit of progressive football is, yeah, it's a worthy thing, and it can be successful up to a point. I guess you need a dose of pragmatism at some point to get all the way. I think, though, for clubs at this level, and I think maybe, I don't know whether this is true or not, but I get the sense that they're kind of struggling to know where they sit in the scheme of things. You know, maybe, and maybe this is just my perceptions or preconceived ideas, because to me, you know, I think back of my formative years and I always thought about Aberdeen as one of the big Scottish clubs because of the successes they had in the 1980s. That was just me as a child, and that was my first knowledge of Aberdeen as a football club. It was winning the Cup Winners' Cup, for goodness sake, you know. This just made me think that they were of that stature as a club, and time has moved on. Dundee United would be another one, perfect example as well. You know, them winning the league, and I guess Hearts to a slightly lesser extent, where they nearly won it all in the 80s and then ended up with nothing. But that made me think of these clubs as being of a similar stature in my youthful, naive mind to the bigger ones. And obviously, as money has grown and grown and grown, that gap has widened. And I wonder, maybe this applies to more clubs than just Aberdeen, but whether they're struggling to know their place in the grand scheme of things now and struggling to accept, whereas the likes of Livingston, you talked about, or clubs that never had that glory, like maybe Motherwell or Kilmarnock or something, and they know their sort of position in things and they can reach to a certain point. But maybe the likes of Aberdeen and Dundee United and Hearts and Hibs, who you think maybe should have bigger means, maybe they're struggling to know where they fit in. As Dave says, it's all about Celtic and Rangers, and it's like the black hole, as you described it sucks everything in. I wonder if there's something in that, and therefore they're having a hard time of things. It's a shame because of this this history. It would be wonderful to see them back again challenging. You know, they used to be part of the new firm, wasn't it? Aberdeen and Dundee United in those days. That would be something. That would be great. But I think it's a forlorn hope. Therefore, what do you cling to? So, as we say, their poor football with results is okay up to a point, but that'll turn people off eventually, even if the results are there. Good football without the results is equally a bit pointless. You know, it's nice for a bit, but then you need a little bit of the joy to go with it. The wins, even if you don't win everything or win all the time. I think, though, to base your approach, therefore, on development, and that can be not just in terms of individual players, but in terms of a style and approach and identity. If you develop that kind of identity and you either bring in players who fit that mold, or you create them yourself. You know, we talked about where Queen's Park can lure players from, and obviously that's a far more populated area than the northeast of Scotland, but Aberdeen have a huge catchment area in terms of geography, if not in terms of population. But you know, there will be people that they can bring in young and develop and I don't know, school in a particular style, a particular approach. That doesn't necessarily have to be the most beautiful approach. It could be a more pragmatic approach, as long as it's something that becomes a little more ingrained and therefore they can build and develop from there. I think maybe that kind of idea is the way to go, but I think there needs to be an acceptance, and this might come up in an English club we might talk about a bit further down the line, a sort of acceptance of where you sit in the grand scheme of things in the modern day when your heyday was 40 years ago.
Yeah. Dave, I'm going to give you a promotion here, mate. And before we move on to my sort of reflective piece, which just touch on Scottish football a little bit as well, I'm just going to make you chairman of Aberdeen Football Club, and you can tell me, when you employ the next guy, are you going to tell him to be pragmatic, or are you going to tell him to sort of sod results, we'll play the game we want to play? Your call, buddy.
Thanks very much. It puts me in mind a little bit of West Brom years and years ago, when... Because at Albion, it's always an obsession with the 1978 team, and they've got to play like Ron Atkinson's team played, and Cyril Regis and Billy Johnston, Laurie Cunningham, blah, 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 blah. And that was an obsession until through the 90s, we were so crap, so consistently, that they didn't care anymore, and they accepted the football that Gary Megson turfed out. And then after two or three years, we'd had enough of that as well. And I think... there's a bit of that at Aberdeen. I don't think Aberdeen supporters are willing to have just pragmatic football. And to be fair to him, and to be fair to Dave Cormack, the chairman as well, he's invested really heavily in it. They're well supported, and you would probably say that the Aberdeen Hibs and Hearts are all much of a muchness in terms of the investment. They should be third, fourth, and fifth, really. You know, logically, you would say. I would go for Barry Robson, who's running there under 18s at the minute. I would give him a chance, actually, because I think he was born and brought up in Aberdeen, played for Celtic, obviously, played for Dundee United, and I think he's schooled in the way that the supporters want to see Aberdeen play. I also have to say that they want somebody who's going to put a rocket up the team, because you can talk all you like about whether Jim Goodwin was a good enough manager for Aberdeen or what, but no professional football team should lose 1-0 at Darvel. Mm. And certainly no professional football team should let the six goals in that they let in yesterday.
Mm. No, you're right. And before that, lost 5-0 as well to Hearts, then lost to Darvel, and then 6-0 to Hibs. So something's wrong somewhere.
And this, don't forget, is the team that was third in the league at the World Cup break.
Yeah.
But it's also, with that Darvel defeat, sorry, Gary, just to finish on there before we move on, is like after a shock like that, which, as Dave says, obviously a seismic one, no professional, let alone top flight team, should be losing to someone in the sixth tier regional league like that. But you need a reaction. You know, he might have lost his job then, but you need a reaction. Now, surely that's a lot of what the discussion was behind the scenes when he got a stay of execution a week ago, was that, well, you need to react. You need to show us what you can do. And to then go and lose 6-0 Hibs, that's a reaction, I guess. But it's not quite what you're after, is it? You need to show something then. And clearly, a rocket up the backside is needed in some respect, because that is astonishing.
Yeah. Okay. So for my sort of reflective topic, I want to talk about two former England midfield greats, which arguably, and one was manager of Scottish club previously, that's Stephen Gerrard and Frank Lampard. When they both went into coaching, there was talk of them very quickly, at least one of them, if not both, in different sort of times, being the next England manager. Gerrard did reasonably well at Rangers, obviously. Then went to Aston Villa and ended up getting the sack. Lampard went to Derby, did okay there, got the Chelsea job, got the sack, got the Everton job, got the sack. The question is, I want to ask you two guys, is given these two guys now have both had unfortunate experiences, shall we say, both been shown the door by clubs in the Premier League, has that sort of diminished their prospects of becoming England managers sometimes down the road? And the second question to follow up on that is, should it? Dave?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think a lot of managers, you know, have ups and downs, they have successes and failures. I think, you know, you look at Frank Lampard and you have to question his judgment in terms of the jobs he's taken, to be honest. Because, yeah, things were going, I know how things later unravelled at Derby financially, but, he'd got to the playoffs with Derby. That was a decent first season. And Chelsea, I understand the pull of, you know, being offered Chelsea, obviously, with his history at the football club. But they were going into that period where they'd got the transfer embargo. You know very well, Gary, that Chelsea don't give managers a huge amount of time. I mean, I think that was a poor decision for him to go there at that point in time. I don't think he was ready for it, and I don't think it was the right football club. And then you've got to question your judgment about going to Everton last year. Because, I mean, we might deal with this a bit further, but, I mean, Everton are not, and not the club where, I mean, I suppose somebody might go there one day and make a miraculous reputation for themselves. But at the minute, it's not looking very likely, is it? You know, Everton is the kind of place that devours managers and spits them out. So just on the basis of that, I think you would have to question his judgment, full stop.
Aidan, Steven Gerrard, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, I guess, comparing the two in terms of their managerial achievements, what he did at Rangers probably is more significant, I guess, of the two. But again, it didn't go so well at Villa. I think it boils down to a lot of cult of personality rather than good coaching, you know. And I imagine Frank Lampard would never have been considered for a Chelsea job based off doing okay with Derby had he not been Frank Lampard. I think that is clear and evident to everybody. And as Dave says, it was probably a mistake for all parties, really. It didn't work out so well. But I think it's a lot to do with the cult of personality, and therefore that's why both of them have got opportunities that other ex-players their age with their coaching background wouldn't have got. I think that can work two ways. So in some ways, it's allowed them the opportunity. It's given them chances that they may not have got. And had they been able to seize them better, or maybe in the way that they both did at their first managerial clubs, they'd have been in, you know, had they been able to continue in that vein, maybe, sure, it would have all gone great. But the step up was too quick, too soon. I think they needed to, I don't know, earn their way a little bit more. And that's hard when you're someone who was a player of the stature of the pair of them, because your name, your reputation is an awful lot, but it's based on playing ability. It's not based on coaching ability. It's an entirely different skill set. That's not to say they couldn't develop it, and maybe they still will, but it was a bit too fast, too soon. I think a club the size of Chelsea for Lampard at that time, that's a huge undertaking, given the pressures that being at a club who's fighting on those levels in the modern day comes with. That was quite a task. And as Dave says, Everton as well. In Gerrard's case, Villa, I don't know. I think he'd built up a strong enough reputation as a manager from his time in Rangers, but it's a wholly different set of pressures and a whole different game to be in, I guess, you know, when you're in the Premier League, not one of those who's got more money than everybody else. You're just one of the pack when he moved to Villa. And that's a hard thing to do. It's a change of mindset from what he'd been at in Rangers. There he had one team to overcome, and he did it, and he did well. But that was the breadth of the challenge there, if I'm not denigrating Scottish football too much there. But it's an entirely different thing. Equally, so you mentioned about England as well, Gary, and I think that's another entirely different story as well, because again, I see that as an entirely different job from club coaching. Maybe, who knows, maybe that's one that would suit either of them better. You never know. I mean, Gareth Southgate's club career wasn't exactly stellar as a manager in advance of becoming part of the FA coaching setup and working, ending up in the top job as a result. Maybe that kind of thing would suit one of them more. Who knows? I noticed Gerrard was speculated as being up for the Poland job at one point, which would have been interesting in terms of accents, if nothing else. But yeah, it could be that they'd be better suited to that. It would be very, very interesting to see where either of them do pitch up next, because I don't know whether they have to swallow their pride a little bit and take a step back to where they were building things and doing well. You know, the Derby and Rangers positions, they were building a bit of work there. I think Gerrard more so, because he was there a bit longer than Lampard was at Derby, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the case. And therefore, maybe Gerrard's got a slightly more solid base to work from, and Lampard needs to do something similar at that kind of level, perhaps. But maybe that's a bit of a a pride situation as well. You know, you've coached Chelsea and now Everton in these situations. Do you want to go back to a championship level? I don't know. You know, he seems a fairly sensible, level-headed character. So maybe he'll see that as well and see that maybe, yes, it has rushed too fast, too soon. Maybe that wasn't all of his own doing. You know, when Chelsea came calling, I'm sure that was something he would struggle to resist given all that he'd done there. So maybe it was a little bit heart-ruling head, perhaps, on both sides. But it would be very interesting to see where they pitch up. I don't know what you think on Lampard's future, Gary.
I think why I wanted to mention this about, particularly about the England job, is I'll just give a couple of examples. Frank Rijkaard, his first coaching job was at Sparta Rotterdam. He was there for one season. Sparta Rotterdam got relegated. The following season, he was given the Dutch national job and got them to the semi-finals, I think, of the European Championship. Franz Beckenbauer won the World Cup as a coach, never coached a club team in his life. I think the point I was sort of trying to raise is that open for discussion is club success as a manager, and you mentioned about Southgate, isn't necessarily a good barometer for success on the international stage. It's an entirely different job. So, I mean, the point I was making, or suggesting maybe the case, is failure as a club manager doesn't necessarily bar you from being a success on the international stage. I mean, when you're talking about international management, you're talking about the creme of the players. You know, you haven't got to teach them basic tactics. You haven't got to teach them how to trap a ball. You've got to pick your players, pick your formation, pick your tactics, and inspire your players. And that's about it, really. You haven't got it's not coaching as much as almost only inspiring. Coaching is a little bit there, but you took the creme to creme of the players. You know, unless you're going to put players in a different position to what they used to be playing, they know how to play those roles. So I guess the question I'm asking to you, you know, perhaps very briefly before we move on, is international football different from club management? And B, is it different enough that failure as a club manager doesn't disbar you from being successful on the international stage? Dave?
I think it is a very different job. We did a podcast about this not too long ago, didn't we, with Chris Evans about it.
You certainly did.
To the World Cup. It is, and it seems increasingly to me that a lot of teams have got this sort of charismatic figurehead. Yeah, I mean, you go back to, I mean, another one to add is Jürgen Klinsmann back in 2006 with Germany, you know, at the point at which Germany was supposedly a failing force and they got all the way through at the semi-finals of that World Cup. I mean, it can't just be charisma that does that, but footballers are always ones for show us your medals. And show us your medals at Wigan Athletic, with all due respect, is different to show us your medals when you're in the England dressing room. And I think it's very difficult for an England dressing room or the French dressing room or whatever to look at a manager like a Graham Taylor, you know, for instance. I think, you know, Gerrard and Lampard, for whatever they've done as managers, and I think Gerrard does actually deserve a bit of credit for what he did at Rangers, because preventing Celtic winning that 10 in a row, that was a big pressure thing for Rangers. I mean, that was, you know, do or die kind of thing. So I think he did achieve something there. But I think international footballers would turn up to see Steven Gerrard in the dressing room or Frank Lampard in the dressing room, and I think they would respond to that in the same way that they seem to have responded to Gareth Southgate. Now, you've got to have more than just being who you are. But I think, as you say, there's a lot more to it. It's a very different job to being a club manager. There's a lot less to international management in some senses than there is. You know, you don't have to buy the players. You don't have to, you know who you've got. These are the English blokes. You've got to pick from them. I think it narrows the focus down. It makes it a little bit more straightforward in that sense. So I don't think it necessarily finishes them off as potential England managers. What the media reaction to that would be, and that what then impact that would then have on the FA in the selection process, that's another story.
Indeed so, mate. Aidan, what do you think? Could they still hit the international stage?
Yeah, absolutely could. Absolutely could. I think we're all agreed it's a totally different thing. And I think it narrows the scope in some ways, but broadens it in others. So you're actually bringing in other things that you wouldn't have to contend with in a club, which is, you know, creating a camp, if you like, you know, creating what sits behind that. Be away for 6 weeks or so for a tournament it's a living together and doing everything together is a wholly different experience to anything you get at a club. So that's where things get expanded out in a different way. I mean, who knows whether they do that. I think, you know, it's a lot comes down to in international coaching, and not just who the number one star name is, if you like. It's who they bring in around them to do a lot of those other things, to lead each aspect of that. And I think if you're able to bring in people who can work on each of those other areas and allow you to focus on the bits you need to focus on, the narrower perspective of the international football, then absolutely no reason at all why it couldn't work, and they couldn't do well. You know, they've probably both had a better managerial club career than Gareth Southgate had so far, which, you know, so have loads of other people too, I guess. But, you know, you certainly couldn't say what they've done or not done as a club manager would rule either of them out, given who England's current manager is and what he'd done. So no, absolutely not.
Good stuff. Okay, well, we sort of blended across from the past to the future there with that little discussion. So sort of segues nicely into the sort of topics for each of us looking forward. So Aidan, you first, what's your sort of projecting forward issue?
Yes, well, mine's been slightly spoiled by events yesterday, but I'm going to carry on with it anyway because my general point still stands. I'm looking at the National League, at the top of the National League. Now, there's a big fixture coming up. I think it's just under a fortnight's time, Notts County against Chesterfield. These are two, or at least they were yesterday. They were second and third up until Chesterfield managed to lose 3-0 yesterday and spoil my little tale. But, you know, with their games in hand, they're still very much in with a shout. The situation, though, is there are a handful of very good teams at the top of the National League, but there's only one automatic position for promotion. Now, Wrexham are currently top. Notts County are just a little bit behind them. Chesterfield have 3 games in hand on Notts County, so the fact that they are double digits of points behind them may not be such a big deal, especially if they manage to win against Notts County coming up. So that's why I was partly wanting to flag that one, because it's potential pivotal game in terms of who may or may not be able to catch Wrexham, but equally in terms of positively going into promotional playoffs. I think if either team are to catch Wrexham, they need to win that game. So that applies to Notts County as much as to Chesterfield. It feels strange to me also to be talking of these club names in this situation as well. And you look down the National League, though, where there's so many of them that from back in the day before they had this this promotion and relegation to the non-leagues, if you like, they were always, to me anyway, I'm sure going back further this wasn't necessarily the case, but to me it always seemed, you know, you had the same 92 and these names were in it. Notts County, obviously, speaking of Queen's Park earlier, they're another massively historic club in the English game. Of these 3 teams, though, Wrexham, Notts County and Chesterfield, which I think from what I've been able to glean have been the 3 best in the National League. At least one of them can't go up, and potentially 2 of them can't go up if the playoff goes a different way. So my main point, therefore, is with this as my little prompt to look ahead at this game, but should promotion and relegation between League 2 and the National League be expanded to 3 or to 4? Or I guess to push that slightly further, should it become part of the Football League entirely now, as it's mostly professional? I think the point of it being league and non-league back in the day was the differentiation between professional and amateur. That's not the case. This league is mostly, if not all, professional, or at least semi-professional. These top clubs are all professional. To make it so hard to get out of that league, it seems easy to fall into it if you go on the slide, but to get out of it again, there's a massive queue waiting to get back up of clubs who are in some cases spending their way to do it, in some cases just knocking on the door again and again and again. And if you're unfortunate enough to get stuck behind one of these clubs with a bit of resource like Wrexham, or a couple of years ago like Salford, or some other examples, you mentioned Rushden and Diamonds before, you know, these kind of clubs, then essentially you're ruling yourself out from any chance of promotion because it's already taken. Should it be expanded, even if it doesn't become part of the Football League? I think just 2 places, when it's a 24-team league at either end, it should be more. It should be at least 3, if not 4. What do you think?
It makes a really good point. I mean, I remember the days when the clubs trying to get into the Football League had to apply for an election, you know, and there was this sort of almost closed shop where everybody used to vote for everybody else to keep everybody else safe. You vote for me and I'll vote for you if you get in trouble. And getting into the Football League was, you know, a massive difficult endeavour. And that pathway has become a lot less a lot less restricted, shall we say, these days. But is it unrestricted enough? I mean, is the National League a surrogate League Three? To my mind, it almost is. And as you say, the definition of being amateur as opposed to professional has gone by the board quite a while ago. And, you know, should the same promotion relegation issues apply to between National League and League Two as is between League Two and League One? To me, I think it absolutely should. And when you talk about the two, those two East Midland clubs, Chesterfield and Notts County, and you mentioned Wrexham as well, there's a lot of clubs in that National League who most people would say, they're in the 92 clubs, without actually looking and realising because of the history they have. Definitely. Hey, don't you think promotion from the National League should be amended?
I would have more come with it. I mean, I looked at the league table earlier today, and I think there were 12 or 13 that are ex-football league in there that I thought they were in League Two.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing how once you fall out, you know, you talk about yo-yo teams between the Premier League and the Championship. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of yo-yo in between League Two and the National League. Once you've gone, it looks like you've had it. I mean, I was looking at the drop zone. You've got Scunthorpe are in the relegation zone in the National League. Torquay United are in there. And Oldham, you know, founder members of the Premier League.
Yes, that's the thing, isn't it?
No one above the drop zone. Yeah, Oldham. Yeah. You know, that is some collapse. But I think, two teams going up seems a bit miserly, doesn't it? I mean, I don't see why if you've got three in every other league and obviously four going up from League Two into League One, why you wouldn't have three or four teams going up from, I still call it the conference, but, you know, National League.
Is the National League sponsored by somebody? And it's that you can't call it League Three? Is there a reason for
that? I believe it is sponsored by somebody, yes, who isn't the same company that sponsors the EFL leagues. But, you know, that's something that would, I guess, change as part of it. It's called the National League, and then after that one, that's the only all national part of it, though, isn't it? The next tiers is a Northern and a Southern. So the pyramid begins, I guess, after this point. And therefore, again, it doesn't quite make sense if you look at it that way as well. Is that, well, the national aspect of the peak of the pyramid starts at the bottom of that league, not when you go from there to League Two. But I think, again, it's the distinction of football league and non-league as used to be. We think of these teams and we talk of them in FA Cup terms, of course, as this is a non-league team that you're facing here. But, you know, what is it about them that makes non-league? Just who sponsors it, what it's called? There's nothing different about it. It's professional. They are just the same as the clubs at the foot of League Two. No different at all, except they're probably better than them.
I guess Aberdeen would probably hope that Darvel wouldn't have been in the 6th or 4th year. The defeat wouldn't have looked so bad. Before we move on, a quick question to you, Dave, with regard to clubs that have dropped out of the league, should they have parachute payments of the sort of ilk that Premier League clubs dropping into the Championship have, or would that be giving them an unfair advantage?
That's a good question, actually. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, I suppose in terms of protecting the football club, they should, by the same logic as the Premier League to the Championship. But I think parachute payments have so massively distorted the Championship over the years that it's a good thing that they don't, you know. I mean, and that's probably why Oldham are at the bottom of the National League, because they haven't been protected in that way, and why Torquay and Scunthorpe are struggling down there, you know. I mean, I guess we're not talking about the same amounts of money either, as, you know, you're paying people in the Premier League as you would be in the Championship, so it's not quite such an imperative. But I think it's on a sporting level, it's much better that they don't get it. And, you know, I don't particularly like the idea of it in the Championship. I understand why, to cushion the blow of having all those footballers on enormous contracts. I get that, but I think it's too distorting, really.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, let's move on. Dave, looking forward. Your topic, mate.
Looking forward and looking back at the same time. 6th of February is not far away. It'll be the 65th anniversary of the Munich disaster. And I think that always gets you to think about all kinds of things, really. One of the great ones is the what ifs, you know. If that hadn't happened, what you know, how would football have gone on? Would England have won the 1958 World Cup? Would Pelé have not won three World Cups? Would Duncan Edwards and Tommy Taylor and Roger Byrne have made a difference with that England side? Would Real Madrid have won the first five European Cups? Would Manchester United have stopped them somewhere along the way? Would Tottenham have been the first team to win the double in the 20th century? Would Manchester United have got there first, or would Manchester United have stopped them in that year by winning the Cup or winning the league or something, you know? Does Bobby Moore pick up the World Cup in 1966, or is it Duncan Edwards, who's the England captain? You know, I mean, there's a lot of... Stephen always talks about his sliding doors moments, doesn't he? I mean, there's an enormous number of sliding doors moments that come out of the Munich disaster. I mean, wider than that, I suppose that disaster was what made Manchester United in a global sense. I mean, such a terrible tragedy, and you know, it's the kind of the James Dean loss in football, isn't it, really? I suppose, you know, all this unfulfilled promise that could have been, what might have been, and all that, and you know, I think to their credit, Manchester United have played the Munich thing very well. They haven't over milked it. They've been pretty dignified, I think, in the way that they've marked it over the years in the stadium, and you know, there's the Munich tunnel now at Old Trafford, which I think is nice, and the clock on the wall, obviously, and all that sort of stuff. I think they've played it well, but just thinking about that, it made me think a bit more about the way football clubs use history, and I can't say that most clubs use it with the same level of integrity that Manchester United have used it, because I think, I can tell you, I know this from bitter personal experience, that football clubs will dig out history at the moment at which it suits them, because they're losing a bunch of games or they want to sell a bunch of new shirts. But it is, we as supporters, we live and breathe all this sort of stuff. And the football clubs, it's lip service, absolute lip service. I think that's one of the things that turns me off most about modern football, is the way that we are as supporters manipulated by it. Yeah. It's very easy to chuck up a statue of whoever your hero is and pretend that that's us honouring our history. It's just to placate supporters. You know, there are virtually no football clubs that are protecting their history. There are no football clubs that are building new archives of interviews with former footballers. There are no football clubs that are building virtual museums. Now, believe me, I've tried. Because they don't care. Because they genuinely have no interest in their history. And you know, when they're telling you that they do, you're being played. I'm telling you, absolutely, you are being played. And I think, you know, when you look at Munich and you see how well that's done and how he's properly honoured by Manchester United. And Manchester United have got many, many faults, as I think we would all attest to. But I think in that sense, Manchester United are very, very good at what they've done with Munich. And you look at the class and the integrity with which they've dealt with that. And then you look at the way other football clubs really couldn't give a monkey's about their history unless it means I can make a few quid out of it. I think that's a big difference. And I think United are to be applauded for that, actually.
Yeah, good call. Aidan, thoughts?
Yeah, I think what Dave said, the point about this is the sort of moment that has propelled them into global attention or global stature, if you like, is key. You know, I guess all clubs have their history. They have a history of sorts, but not of this kind. You know, there's only a few clubs have a history of this kind, and it's a permanent scar on the club. It's something that has to be acknowledged and noted. But yeah, the way you deal with it and how you deal with it is revealing, I guess, at times, right? You know, not every club has something of this level to compare against. But I mean, equally, it is part of their history. It's part of their identity. And I think that's key. It's led them down the path of what ifs and what might have happened in certain other events. But Manchester United as a club, it's led them, the tragedy has led them on a path to becoming one of the, I guess, whatever we think of them now, one of the most iconic, known, and to be fair, loved clubs all over the world. I don't know that they would have done it in quite the same way without it. You know, I still think they would have had their allure and appeal just given their size and success and all of that. But, you know, I think having this in their past as well enhances that story. I guess Liverpool has similar with tragedy as well that enhances their story and their appeal. But the difference, I guess, is that for Manchester United, this happened while they were still on the rise. For Liverpool, it happened at a different stage of their history. So I think it sits in a slightly different way in a slightly different place. Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Dave said, really, in terms of how it's been handled by them. And maybe there are lessons for other clubs, but I think it's obviously because it's a slightly different type of history than many clubs are talking about, that it's not something you would play on in that way, in the same way others might, you know, wheel out some old player every now and then to drum a bit of support. This is a slightly different category of history, isn't it? And it's definitely what makes them and part of what they are and has enhanced the appeal of the club, certainly. It's what's made them global to an extent as well. But yeah, I think it's something that shouldn't ever get forgotten, basically. You know, it was a tragedy, and it was not just a footballing tragedy, it was a personal tragedy, and it, you know, the impact it's had on those who were left to carry on was deep as well. I mean, would Bobby Charlton have been a slightly different character had he not gone through this at such a young age? He was always, you know, slightly more introspective than his outlandish brother, I guess, but, you know, maybe he'd have been less so had this not happened and damaged him in a way. You could say this about many of the others too, but yeah, absolutely. It always needs to be marked, always needs to be remembered, but a key part of their history and identity.
Yeah, just picking up on one of the issues Dave mentioned about, you know, the what if. And it wasn't until I wrote my book about England's history in the World Cup that I realised the Munich disaster came so close to the squad being selected and sent to Sweden. And, you know, the players that England couldn't play, I mean, it seems a bit prosaic, so I apologise in advance if it sounds that way. You wonder if the likes of Duncan Edwards, Tommy Taylor had been able to go to. I mean, England didn't do that badly. I think they lost out to the Soviet Union in a playoff at the group, if I'm reserving correct. But you wonder where a talent like Duncan Edwards, what kind of player could he have been? I mean, could he have been one of... I mean, this guy was like a man playing in a kid's team, even though he was a kid at that sort of stage of his career. And you wonder what kind of player this guy could have turned into. I mean, you know, the tragedy of his death is one thing, but you wonder, you know, that sliding doors moment, that what if moment that you mentioned, Dave.
The what if goes the other way in terms of World Cup as well, because Jimmy Murphy, the Wales, or the Man United assistant coach, he was managing Wales in a playoff against Israel at the time, and therefore wasn't on this plane on this fateful flight. You know, Wales weren't even meant to be in that playoff. They were the second out of the hat. You know, if all these coincidences hadn't happened, he'd have been on there as well. And who knows what would have happened to Wales? It's too much to think of at times, isn't it?
Okay. I just want to move on to sort of, My sort of looking forward situation. I'm back to sort of managers and coaches and things. Everton, it seems likely that it's at the time of recording, and, you know, who can say what's going to happen next in the next 5 minutes? it seems like at the moment of recording that Sean Dyche seems to be favourite to get the Everton job. And, you know, they were talking to Bielsa as well. I mean, I'm not sure you can get much more different approaches between Bielsa and Dyche. And you wonder, are Everton a club looking for an identity? You know, they've gone through Lampard, they've gone through Benitez, Ancelotti. And you wonder, as I say, are they a team in search of a characteristic that's sort of been lost? The School of Science seems to be a distant memory. And there's who are Everton now? Are Everton Sean Dyche? Is Sean, I mean, I saw an article in one of the articles they have today, they're saying Sean Dyche is the new Sam Allardyce. And I think that's a little bit harsh on Dyche, because he's, you know, it's almost because it was a record of keeping smaller clubs up rather than the way he plays. Interesting. So a couple of questions to each of you. A, Dyche or Bielsa? B, are Everton looking for identity? So there's a couple of ones. So I'll throw it to you first, Dave. Away you go, Tiger.
I don't know what are the conversations that lead you to a path where we'll have either Bielsa or Dyche. Possible logic leads you in that direction. I mean, ignoring the fact that Bielsa doesn't take over football clubs in the middle of a season. I mean, that's the way he operates. He will only come in at the end of the at the end of a season and train the team the way he wants them to be and coaches them through the first season. So, I mean, before you started, it's a bit of a non-starter. But I mean, it just astonishes me that football clubs talk about these projects and then they do absolutely ludicrous things like this. They've brought a squad of players to play in a particular way, and then you get two managers who will play in diametrically opposed methods, and you think both of them can do an equally good job? That's just absolutely barmy. I mean, Everton haven't won anything since 1995. When we go back to the 80s, and it was all the Big Six, and they were going to break away from the Division One and all that. Everton were one of the Big Six. I mean, you wouldn't even think of Everton as one of the Big Six now. I mean, even post 95, for a club of their stature, they've been absolutely dreadful. Even in the David Moyes years when they were routinely finished in the top eight, they was it once they qualified for the Champions League, I think?
Playoff, I think, yeah. They lost out in the qualifying round. Yeah.
Everton have only done that. I was looking through some of the stats earlier on. Moyes had a win rate of 42%, and Martinez was 42%. And Koeman was 42%. There's a theme here. Allardyce was 38, Silva was 40, Ancelotti was 46, and then Benitez 32, Lampard 28. Now, there's some reasonable managerial talent amongst that lot, you would have to say. Yeah. And none of them, other than Ancelotti. I mean, they were unlucky with Ancelotti.
Yes, that's true.
You know, had Ancelotti stayed and still been there now, I think we'd be talking about a very different Everton, to be fair to them. But you look at the others and they just did what Everton do. And then Benitez, which was, again,
interesting.
Through anybody's mind to appoint the ex-Liverpool manager at Everton. How on earth is that going to work? You know, it's like appointing Kenny Dalglish as Rangers manager.
Yeah.
It's just insane. So, you know, and then you get to the end of last season and Frank Lampard or the crowd or whoever it is you want to give the credit to keeps them up by the skin of their teeth. They sell Richarlison, who scored, what was it, 6 goals in the last 9 games to keep him up. Didn't bother replacing him with anybody remotely of the same quality. And now they're surprised that they're stuck at the bottom of the division. It doesn't speak of a board that knows what it's doing tonight.
Yeah. Sold Richarlison and bought Neil Maupay. It's
not the same thing, is it?
Not the same thing, really. Aidan, what do you think, buddy? So, you know, I'm going to give you the situation I gave to Dave earlier. You know, you're now Ken Wright or Mashiri, whoever makes the decision. Would you like to? I'll take it on board Dave's point about Bielsa doesn't go mid-season. But let's put that aside for a moment. If you could, would you go Bielsa or would you go Dyche?
I would go the Bielsa way because I think it's more aesthetically pleasing and I would be happier with that. Even if they then went down, look at what he did with Leeds and galvanised them and brought them up. I think, you know, if it was on condition that, you know, he'd stay if they go down and he would bring them back up again, then that would be, to me, the way to go because that's where you will craft an identity that people can actually buy into. And I think the Dyche, yes, that's an identity too. And it seems a little more short-termist to me. I think they'd have a better chance of building something more lasting if they'd followed the Bielsa path. But as you rightly say, what a bizarre pair of choices to come up with. And I think you said there about, well, whoever makes the decision, Ken Wright, Mashiri and so on, well, they didn't even seem to know. And some of the pronouncements that were coming out recently about who may or may not make the decision about Lampard leaving and the replacement coming in. And I think it's going beyond a lack of identity. They're in search of a plan, any plan. They just don't have one. It's all off the hoof. There's, again, like I mentioned about Aberdeen earlier, and I think this is where it applies far more, Everton. They're unsure or uncertain of their place in the modern world, in the modern league. There was a really interesting article actually from Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian this weekend on this theme. And, you know, he talked about the fact that as Everton have won the league relatively recently, as he put it, you know, it's nearly 40 years now, but, you know, at least that's in living memory of many of the fans, or at least in certainly in terms of those in charge of the club. It makes it hard for them as a club, and I think this is as a club rather than as a fan base, to accept their current position and what their role is in the sort of natural order of things. This should be in terms of finding players, developing them, and then accepting that they will move on to bigger and better, which is, I guess, what Richarlison has done, and maybe Anthony Gordon is another one from hot topics there. You know, I think, though, you know, several clubs can make a big success of that. Look at Brighton right now and what they're achieving on a far lower base than Everton ought to be able to give. But they know where they sit. They know what they need to do, and they know what their sort of position is, and they probably know where they can reach with that. But they're actually doing incredibly, incredibly well. Everton, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but maybe Everton as a club, as an entity, thinks or is trying to think in terms of reclaiming what they see as theirs, what their position. You know, we talked about the Big Six from 30-odd years ago. That was Everton, and it certainly wouldn't have been Chelsea or Manchester City. But look at the world now. It's very, very different. You know, that Big Six changes, and it will change again, I'm quite sure. And maybe in 20 years' time, Everton will be back up there again. Who knows? But they're certainly not of that stature or even close to now. And I think this article, it was suggesting that, that's kind of holding them back because they're not accepting or haven't accepted where they sit now and what their role is. I think there's an element of truth in this. I don't know if it's quite fully right because it is quite some time ago. But it was not that long ago, as we said, as Dave said there, that they were regularly finishing the top eight and pushing in and around European places, got the top four once, qualified for Europe several times. You know, that's not that long ago. And that's obviously the position, I guess, if you talk to fans, that they think they would like to reach again right now. But I think the club itself is struggling to find its real place. And in terms of Deitch or Bielsa, this just shows there is simply no succession plan. They didn't have a plan in mind when they got rid of Frank Lampard. You know, the writing had been on the wall for some time. It wasn't like it was a bolt from the blue. You know, I think they could see it heading this way for some time. That's when you do this succession planning. That's when you have some idea, or maybe you should always have some sort of an idea of the type of person you want, the type of characteristic, the type of style, the type of approach. It's not just playing style that Bielsa and Deitch are worlds apart. I think it's pretty much everything else about them as well. You know, you're going from black to white in essence there, and that just shows there is no plan, there is no clue, no real idea. And it's a shame, but I guess one positive, if they were to go down, is that sometimes relegation can be a good cleanser. And I do emphasize the sometimes there, but it can allow a bit of a reboot, a refresh. It can help you purge a lot of what's wrong in terms of players, coaches, just overall attitude, I guess, as well. You know, it can make a big change, allow you to build again with a more solid base. Endlessly, year after year, trying to stave off relegation, it's a miserable existence for the team, for the club, for the fans. Relegation, despite what the self-promotion of the Premier League and various TV channels would make you believe, it's not the end of the world. The Championship it can be fun. You know, Newcastle have been down there a couple of times in recent years, and maybe it's not going to happen again anytime soon, unless the money disappears, which who knows. But you know, it on both occasions, it allowed a total reset and reboot and got to move on a lot of dead wood. And it allowed things to start again, where Newcastle were fortunate, of course, and Villa as well in recent times, or more now, you could mention Fulham and Burnley are able to come straight back up, or probably coming straight back up in Burnley's case. That's a risk. That does not always happen for every club like those. There's also a Nottingham Forest, a Leeds, a Sunderland, a Sheffield Wednesday, a Charlton and so on, who just disappear, a Blackburn, and don't reappear for vast periods of time, if at all. So yes, it's not without risk, but sometimes it can help purge, and it can bring a bit of fun back as well, frankly. Yeah. Winning games is fun. It's entertaining. Struggling and hating it week after week after week isn't fun for anybody. So, you know, it isn't the end of the world going down, but you do wonder how it's all going to go with. I think Deitch, probably more so than Bielsa, will have the chance to keep them up this season. Bielsa, I think, would have led to a longer-term better position, though, for Everton than the Deitch path would.
Yeah, the one thing you can say about Everton is they have got historical precedent, because they went down when Dixie Dean was still playing for them. They got promoted in 31, won the first division in 32. So, you know, there's always hope.
They could do it on the centenary anniversary of that.
I think the bigger complication for Everton is obviously the new stadium.
Yeah.
You know, the prospect of building that and having to go through all of that process and having a relegation in there and then thinking about coming back and getting promoted and blah, blah, blah. I think that makes, you know, the survival element all the more imperative.
Well, having put Everton to rights, let's wrap things up there for this week. Gary has disappeared off into the Spanish internet gremlin death zone. Whether he reappears or not in the next few seconds or not, I don't know. But if not, I will sign us off for now. So thank you very much, Dave, for all of your contributions tonight.
It's been a pleasure, all the highways and byways of English football and discovering the plight of Oldham Athletic. That's been an interesting byproduct of today.
We're always learning something. That's it. It's educational, and hopefully it has been for our listeners too, listening to us ramble our way across Scotland, England, and various weird stops on the way that we may not have expected, and also Everton that I think we very much did expect. But thank you very much for listening, and do join us again next time on These Football Times. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.